Good morning.
Morning.
The next matter on our calendar is State of Minnesota versus Kristen Ann Altepeter. Our file number A182086, and we're appearing by ITV. Our counsel are, and we are here at the Judicial Center. And we just ask counsel if you would identify yourself for the record when you do approach the podium at your location, and also make sure that you're able to see visually the clock, the timing, so that you can observe that as well. Will be just one moment. Very well. Counsel for appellant, if you would approach the podium, you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Kristen Altepeter. This court must reverse Ms. Altepeter's conviction for malicious punishment of a child because she did not maliciously punish a child. To the contrary, Ms. Altepeter took action to stop the child from returning to a dangerous situation, endangering his own safety and the safety of the other children in Ms. Altepeter's care. More specifically, this court must reverse the conviction on three different grounds. First, any force that Ms. Altepeter used was not used in the course of punishment. The malicious punishment statute prohibits the use of unreasonable force in the course of punishment. That is the entire purpose.
Let me ask you about a recent unpublished case, State v. Murray. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, Your Honor. Please go ahead.
So it seems that we've rejected that argument in my reading of Murray. How do you respond to that, other than saying it's unpublished?
Well, I'll start with that. That is addressed in some detail in the reply brief, Your Honor. One of the problems with Murray is that it does not address it only looks at the language of subdivision one of the statute. It doesn't read the statute as a whole, and it doesn't address subdivisions 2, 4, 5, and 6, all of which refer to, quote, the punishment, end quote. So those parts of the statutes, which are the penalty parts, say that if, quote, the punishment, end quote, results in certain harm or non-certain harm, the crime may be punished as follows. So those words, the punishment, have to refer back to the conduct criminalized in subdivision one. Now this makes sense because, again, the title of the statute, which is not part of the statute, but is certainly relevant in determining the intent of the legislature when it drafted the statute, is malicious punishment of a child, and it is limited to unreasonable force or cruel discipline by a caregiver. All of this combines to show that any force that's used must be used in the course of punishment, which is exactly how the jury in this case was instructed. Without objection by the prosecution, the jury in this case was instructed that any force had to be used in the course of punishment. And if you look at almost every malicious punishment case, I only say almost because I always like to hedge, like maybe there's one I didn't find, but every malicious punishment case I found, that's exactly what it is. They are almost all corporal punishment cases. Child does something wrong, and child's caregiver, as a penalty for that, as a punishment for that behavior, inflicts some sort of pain or bodily harm or unreasonable force on the child as a consequence for the child's actions. That is not what we have here. What we have here is Ms. Altepeter, for the second time after the first time, the child returned to the dangerous situation after being told not to do so. So now we're on the second time. She's also told again not to return to the monkey bars where the picnic table is on top of. He is trying to wiggle away from her to go back there again for a third time. And Ms. Altepeter holds him by his arms, at his elbows, with her hands, while she tells him he can't do that. Because even though he can normally play on the monkey bars, today he can't because of the picnic table. She then says, now you need to go sit in timeout. And so he does. Without incident, he goes and sits in timeout. If there's a punishment here, it's going to sit in timeout. That punishment has no force whatsoever. The holding him by the elbows, pulling him on the arms by the elbows, was not punishment. It was simply holding him in place so she could talk to him, as any caregiver would do. And the state, in its closing argument to the jury, seemed to at least subtly concede this point at page 184 of the record, when they say that prosecutor says that Ms. Altapeter acted, quote, not to discipline, end quote, JDR, the child in this case. Because the force was not used in the course of punishment, it was not corporal punishment, it was not designed to correct behavior, it was only designed to hold the child in place, it's not malicious punishment. It doesn't fall under the ambit of the statute. It's entirely possible, and the state's brief references cases charging assaults, and cases like Dorn and Fleck, which interpret the assault statute, and say, well, those cases show that you just need to do some sort of intentional act that results in harm. And that may be true for the assault statute, but the assault statute is much broader, or stated another way, the malicious punishment statute is much narrower than the assault statute.
What if, I guess I'm going to offer a hypothetical that might not, I don't know, it may seem implausible, but what if you had a parent or guardian who believed it was necessary to strike a child to keep the child from leaving the area while the parent gave the child instructions about behavior that the child was engaging in. But the striking of the child wasn't intended to punish for any particular thing. It was just simply to get the child's attention, to make sure the child doesn't move around or run away from the room while the parent is speaking. Would that fall under the statute? Or I gather your distinction between punishment and some other purpose would render that outside the purview of the statute.
I think, Your Honor, that depending on the facts and circumstances, that may very well fall outside the purview of the statute. It would very clearly fall into the purview of the assault statute. So if there's a crime there, it might be a domestic assault, or it might be a fifth-degree assault. Or if more serious bodily harm is imposed by the parent, it might be a more serious form of assault. In addition, I agree that the line between punishment and pre-punishment actions or something along those lines, it can be pretty blurry. I'm not saying there's always a bright line here. I think for the purposes of this case, though, all this court has to recognize is that under these facts, Ms. Altapeter was not punishing the child when she was holding him in place to keep him away from a dangerous situation. That's the other difference, maybe, Your Honor, between this case and your hypothetical. In your hypothetical, perhaps the parent is trying to prevent the child from being naughty. In this case, Ms. Altapeter is not just enforcing some random rule. She is trying to keep the child safe. The child is acting in a patently unsafe way, as four-year-old children do on a regular basis. But it's her obligation as the caregiver not only to enforce the rules of her daycare just to maintain peace and order amongst the children, but above all, to keep the children safe, including all of the other children in her care.
Well, sometimes children are disciplined in order to prevent them from engaging in unsafe behavior. Let's say instead of monkey bars, it was a stove. I want to keep the child from touching the hot stove. And in order to hold the child, maybe you spank the child mildly to use corporal punishment so the child knows not to touch the stove. Or you might say that it's discipline for the child having touched the stove in violation of a rule not to touch the stove. But both of them ultimately are designed for the child's protection and safety.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. And under both of those hypotheticals, the person may well be guilty, because in both of those hypotheticals, the person has spanked the child to punish the child. Ms. Altapeter didn't strike this child. She didn't smack him on the head to get his attention. She didn't hold him down. down on the ground or pinned down with her forearm on his neck so that he wouldn't move. She held him in place by holding his arms at the elbows so she could talk to him. And I think that is qualitatively different from any spanking hypothetical that's out there, or maybe particularly more appropriate, all of the malicious punishment cases.
Do you think there's a difference between punishment and discipline?
Maybe theoretically, but again, Your Honor, even if there's not, even if that's a hair too fine to split, here, Ms. Altheater, when she holds the child, is unquestionably not punishing him. She's holding him so she can talk to him. And more to the point, even if this distinction is too ephemeral, and I don't think it is under these facts, but even if it is, her actions are simply not unreasonable.
Well, do you think it was unreasonable to leave a heavy picnic table, as I understand it, on top of the monkey bars, making it an attractive nuisance?
You know, that might have been not the best date for a way to run a daycare. And if DHS wants to come in and affect her license for that, that's fine. But the attractive nuisance part of this case actually gives Ms. Altheater more responsibility, not less. Because she can't claim, there's no way she could claim, I didn't know this was a problem. If the child had been hurt, if JDR had been hurt while climbing on the monkey bars and pushed the picnic table off, or if, God forbid, another child had been hurt, there's no way Ms. Altheater could say she's somehow not responsible. She's 100% responsible.
Well, isn't, don't, so we,
she has to fix it.
Mr. Butler, we have a jury verdict here. And so generally, a reasonableness determination is a finding of fact determined by the jury.
That's true, Your Honor. And I don't dispute the standard of review. That is very difficult in a case like this.
And would you also agree that the evidence the state presented was direct evidence?
Yes, I do. I do agree with that. And so that the standard review, I don't think the respondent and I disagree about what the standard of review is. It's cited in our brief. It does include the fact that this court can view the evidence, and if this court views the evidence and concludes that no reasonable jury could have found that these actions were unreasonable, that this court can reverse the conviction. And that's what this court recently did in the Pickett case, in a similar situation. Pickett was a child endangerment case. And in Pickett, the jury concluded that the conditions the child were in was likely to cause the child physical or emotional harm. That's a direct evidence case. And this court looked at the direct evidence and said no reasonable jury could have made that conclusion and reversed the conviction. Pickett is unpublished, of course. It's not precedential. But it is an example of when this court looks at a qualitative decision that a jury makes, in that case likely, in this case reasonableness, and can look at the direct evidence and in a rare case come to a different conclusion than the jury did. And that is what we're asking the court to do here if the court reaches the reasonableness part of this inquiry. On the punishment part of the inquiry, it is a little bit more whether this conduct fits in the ambit of the statute or not. But on reasonableness, I agree, that is a qualitative decision. So I think I've covered why this force wasn't used in the course of punishment. I've touched on why the force was not unreasonable. This court has, in the reasonableness cases, suggested or held that the fact finder needs to look at all of the circumstances, which include the age of the child, the height of the child, the weight of the child, the seriousness of the infraction, the physical impact of the discipline. In this case, the only one of those facts that the state really relies on is the physical impact of the discipline, or the alleged discipline, which is some bruises on the child's elbows. That's it. If you look at the prosecutor's closing argument, he at one point says, he holds up a picture, I don't know which one it is, there are several, holds up a picture of the bruises and says, jury, this is all you need to see. Because their argument seems to be that if there are bruises, then ipso facto, the amount of force is unreasonable. And that is not what the statute says. That's not what the malicious punishment statute says. And that's not what this court's case law counsels a jury to do, and certainly doesn't counsel a reviewing court to do, which is to just look at only are there some bruises, ergo the force must be unreasonable. That, as I understand it, was the state's argument to the jury and remains it here. In my last 30 seconds, I just want to add that Ms. Altapeter's conduct is also not malicious. Ms. Altapeter's desire here was to stop JPR from injuring himself or injuring other children in Ms. Altapeter's care. It was not to hurt JPR just for the sake of hurting him or seeing him suffer. That's what these malicious punishment cases are. That's what all of them are. That is not what this case is. This court should reverse Ms. Altapeter's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Counsel for respondent, you may approach your podium and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. I'm appearing here in Crookston this morning. There's one point I want to start out with, and that relates to the standard of review, which counsel, as I heard him say, he doesn't dispute as it applies to this case. And that standard is pretty straightforward. That is, the evidence is supposed to be viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict. Any evidence inconsistent with that verdict is supposed to be disregarded. The jury has a right to believe part of a witness's testimony, disbelieve part of it. And yet counsel's entire argument, as he just made to this court, is you should believe what Kristen Altapeter said when she testified at trial. This relates directly to this punishment argument. Whether or not punishment is a separate element of the crime, and I dispute that it is. Judge Riley, to the question that you asked counsel, I'll just jump in quick and say, I believe that punishment is used in subdivisions 2-6 of the statute is simply a shorthand mechanism for the legislature rather than saying the unreasonable use of force or cruel discipline by a parent, guardian, or caretaker under the circumstances. It's not a separate independent element of the crime.
Mr. Bueller, do you believe the jury instruction causes confusion, the pattern jury instruction which references punishment?
I believe that it could. I think in this case, in speaking of jury instructions, I frankly would say one problem with the jury instruction in this case that wasn't raised on appeal is defining reasonableness. I do think that is something that in the future Krimjic should be looking at, is defining those elements or factors to be considered in making a reasonableness determination. I think that would make it, at least it would guide the jury's decision-making process. But no issue has been raised in this case with regard to the jury instructions. But this issue with regard to punishment plays into the proper standard of review, because counsel's entire argument hinges upon this court accepting Ms. Altapeter's testimony that she was merely acting to try to correct this 4-year-old child's alleged misbehavior. But the jury didn't have to believe her. The jury very easily could have concluded on these facts that she was frustrated, that she acted out of anger when she grabbed him by the elbows, and thereafter inflicts bruising on his elbows and immediately sends him to a timeout. Now, counsel wants to separate the infliction of bruising on this child's arms from the timeout. They occurred one right after the other. We don't send children to timeouts to reward them. We send them to punish them, to discipline them. But a child is injured and immediately told to go to timeout. Can't separate the two of them. That is punishment, pure and simple. So even if punishment is an element of the crime, the jury rationally could have reached that conclusion on these facts. And again, there's this blurry distinction between punishment, discipline, reasonable, unreasonable. What this really boils down to is it's a judgment call by a properly instructed jury. And in this case, the jury heard, saw, and believed all the evidence that the state presented. And I think one thing this court also should look at is, I believe everybody who was involved in trying this case agreed that this was a fact question for the jury to decide. Judge Yan presided over the trial, the prosecutor, the defense attorney. They all were arguing, was Ms. Altapeter's actions reasonable or not? There wasn't any motion for a directed verdict after the conclusion of the state's case. There wasn't a motion for a directed verdict after the jury's verdict came in. Judge Yan never acted sua sponte to step in to set aside the verdict. There wasn't ever a motion for a new trial filed. In fact, I think Judge Yan summed it up properly at sentencing when she said, we were all there to see everyone's testimony and see the evidence, and the jury was as well. And so the jury did reach a verdict, and the court has accepted that verdict. That's really what this boils down to. Is we ask juries all the time to make reasonable determinations, and in this case, they found the appellant's actions to be unreasonable.
And Mr. Buehler, the agreement or the disputed fact in terms of the statutory element was unreasonable force. In other words, the state's theory was not cruel discipline, and your position was you need not prove discipline or slash punishment, and you apparently told the jury that in closing. Your whole focus on the state's case was unreasonable force.
That's what the prosecutor in this case did, Your Honor. I didn't try this case. It was another member.
Okay.
That is exactly what the argument was, that her actions were unreasonable under these circumstances.
And you believe the Murray decision is a correct interpretation of the statute, and in fact that's how the state looked at it in presenting its case.
I do, and more importantly, Your Honor, I think that this court's opinion in State versus Myers decided in 2012, again, it's an unpublished opinion, but it was one that was cited by appellant's counsel in their principal brief, and I think this court accurately summarized the law in the state when it said, this court generally upholds findings of unreasonable force and convictions of malicious punishment of a child where evidence at trial showed that a parent or caretaker inflicted spankings which caused resulting bruises or injury. Precedent and relevant statutes not focus on how the injury to the child occurred, be it by instrumentality or by bare hand, but instead of whether the physical injury occurred at all. This court then went on to cite its opinion in Johnson, a published opinion, said the law does not condone injury of children, and yet that's precisely what appellant was asking this court to do. Now, counsel just argued to this court that the child in this case was acting in a patently unsafe manner, and as I heard him correctly, I believe he said, as children on a regular basis do. But parents, guardians, caretakers do not routinely bruise children when either punishing them, disciplining them, or dealing with misbehavior. That's the difference here. She engaged in behavior of sufficient egregiousness that it resulted in actual bruising to this child. And I'll be candid with the court. The first time that I read this transcript, after 25 years as a prosecutor, when I hear fingertip bruising, the first thing that comes to my mind is domestic violence. It's an indicator in many of our cases of domestic violence. That is, individuals grabbing with sufficient force that they inflict bruising. That doesn't happen very often to children. Now, I'm not saying that all bruising in every case would result in a malicious punishment of a child conviction. I mean, there are circumstances where I could envision that it wouldn't be the case. Foremost being where the person's actions were accidental, that is, they didn't intentionally do the act that they're accused of. Second, if the actions are taken to avoid a life-threatening situation not created by the person, that is, a child runs out in front of an oncoming car or truck and they yank them and bring them back and end up bruising them. I have a problem with the appellant's argument in this case that somehow Ms. Alterpeter should be rewarded for creating a dangerous situation. In fact, as I read the transcript in this case, I think an alternative charge that should have been brought against Ms. Alterpeter was child endangerment. If, in fact, the circumstance in the backyard was as dangerous as she makes it out to be and testified to, then she clearly created the circumstance and allowed this child not once but twice to be exposed to that danger. I don't think she should be rewarded for bruising a child in a circumstance where she created the dangerous circumstance.
I'm not sure I track. Very favorably your argument. You're suggesting if a parent or a guardian somehow has a dangerous situation that the parent or guardian improperly has put in place and then recognizes that danger and tries to grab a child to prevent the child from being harmed by that danger, that it's somehow rewarding the parent in concluding that that's not doesn't fall under the malicious discipline statute. I don't know that I interpret your hypothetical in the same way.
Your Honor, I just want to talk to you more about these particular facts. Where she's running a daycare and is putting a heavy picnic table that she said was heavy enough that it required her and her son to put on there, and she was so concerned about the four-year-old getting out of there might be able to knock this off.
No, I understand those facts, but you're saying, well, that was a really foolish thing to do, and I'm just saying it may be so. But parents do foolish things, creating hazards by overlooking them until perhaps they see the moment where a child might in fact be in danger. You seem to be suggesting if a parent grabs a child at that moment, forcefully to save the child, that the parent somehow, that preventing prosecution for malicious punishment at that time would somehow be a reward to the parent. I'm not sure that I agree with the conclusion in the hypothetical.
You're not necessarily going that far. Maybe I just told what I'm saying, responding to his counsel's argument, is that he continually relies upon the fact that it was Ms. Alterpeter who was doing this to somehow save this child. It wasn't after the first time, it was after the second time, but did so in a manner sufficient to inflict bruising on the child. I have a hard time separating out the fact that it's a dangerous situation she created in a daycare setting and still allowed a child into the backyard, knowing that that was the circumstance. That's as far as I was trying to go. I wasn't trying to make a general proposition about any other circumstance. I'm more concerned about this particular circumstance with the daycare setting. And if it was as dangerous as Ms. Alterpeter says it was, that's a real problem in allowing any child into the backyard at that time.
Well, it seems to me the state would have the option of then charging differently for some other crime, but we're limited to the crime of conviction, aren't we here?
We are, Your Honor. And I simply was trying to make the point, though, that I believe that, as counsel was arguing in his case, that Ms. Alterpeter was acting in a manner that could be justified here. I also believe that from the outset, if this was in fact such a dangerous situation, it was a separate crime that she may have committed, gross misdemeanor, child endangerment, something she was not charged with and is not under consideration by this court. I just was making the counterpoint that there's more to this story than just saying she acted to save this child. She also was the person who created the dangerous situation.
How would you respond, let's change the facts and make it into the more quintessential parent tries to save or guardian tries to protect the child circumstance. If you had a parent saying, don't run out into the road, and the child is running into the road, and the parent takes hold of the child, and before punishing the child by putting the child in a timeout for entering, walking towards the shoulder, the parent is holding the child and trying to prevent the child from leaving so that the parent can communicate. So you've got a child who's wild, hyperactive, running around, and the parent is just trying, the guardian is just trying to hold the child's attention by physically holding the child, and in the case happens to cause bruising. Is that holding of the child before the discipline of the timeout punishment in your understanding of the law?
Well, as I indicated at the outset, Your Honor, I don't believe you can separate that conduct into individual segments. That is, grabbing, holding the child, sending them to a timeout immediately thereafter. I think it has to be viewed in the totality. And again, when we're looking at reasonableness determinations, it's usually the entire circumstances that are being considered, not just an individual one particular circumstance.
Even if that part of the story was not intended to be punishment, you're saying?
Correct. Because I believe it comes down to, was it an unreasonable use of force by a parent, guardian, or caretaker? That is the operative language, not whether that amounted to a separate independent determination of punishment. And when I go... And again, there would be one other alternative that I also look to when it comes to bruising. That is, there are some children who easily bruise due to physical conditions, disease, things along those lines. But again, there isn't anything in the evidence in this record. We're talking about someone who grabbed a 4-year-old child with sufficient force to inflict bruises on both of their elbows. I find that troubling. You know, caretakers are supposed to be taking care of children by definition, especially in the daycare setting. Well, this court has even gone so far as to hold that a parent who engaged in overzealous tickling with the child committed malicious punishment of a child in the O'Brien case. And parents are entitled to, I think, more deference when it comes to how they deal with their children, their children's misbehavior, whether punishing them, disciplining them. I don't think daycare providers would be granted the same leeway that a parent would.
Is there anything in the statute that would suggest a difference?
Well, there is not, Your Honor. I'm just saying, as a matter of common sense, that I believe that parents, if they are going to be entitled to discipline their children, would be granted more leeway than someone who is standing in their stead in a daycare that they're paying for. But on these facts, we have a child, a 4-year-old, who was grabbed with sufficient force to inflict bruises on both of his arms. I believe that is the bright line in this case, according to Myers and cases like it, in which it goes from being reasonable to unreasonable, and at a minimum, it was the jury who determined this to be unreasonable after seeing and hearing the witnesses testify. They heard Ms. Altemeter testify at trial, they heard her explanation, they heard her attempt to justify her actions, and they rejected it. And I believe on these facts, it was warranted, and that the jury's verdict should be affirmed because there is evidence in the record. I believe her actions, combined with the bruising inflicted upon this child, are sufficient to find it unreasonable under these circumstances. See, I'm down to about 30 seconds or so here. If there isn't anything else, I'll finish up my argument unless you have some further questions.
No other questions.
Thank you for allowing me to appear today.
Thank you, Mr. Bueller. And Mr. Butler, on behalf of the appellant, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. As I understand the respondent's argument, the malicious punishment of a child statute requires neither maliciousness nor punishment. I'd say that's a very strange piece of statutory drafting, if that's in fact what the legislature did. And I would suggest that that doesn't make any sense and that that's not what the legislature did. When the legislature criminalizes unreasonable force or cruel discipline in this context, what they mean is exactly what they say, which is punishment designed not to correct the child's behavior or not solely to correct the child's behavior, but also designed to hurt the child, to make the child suffer. And that is what every malicious punishment case that I found that cited in both briefs, that's what they all involve. And that's not what this case involves. And that's true regardless of what you think the jury thought of Ms. Altemeter's testimony. Because it is, of course, true that you have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, and the jury can believe parts or and disbelieve parts of a witness's testimony. The problem with the state here is that the facts here are undisputed. There's only one account of the facts, and that's Ms. Altemeter's. And it's undisputed that she held the child by his arms briefly when she told him not to go back on the unsafe monkey bars. It doesn't matter who made the monkey bars unsafe. Her other option was, of course, to let the child go back on the unsafe monkey bars, which would have been a terrible decision.
Mr. Butler, might the jury, despite the fact that there was no other testimony as to motive, wasn't the jury free to disbelieve your client's position regarding the motive for grabbing the child and conclude that it was part of the punishment for being on the monkey bars?
I would agree, Your Honor, with the first thing you said, but maybe not with the second. I mean, I think if the jury rejects something, they reject it, and that is just out. But a rejection doesn't create other evidence that comes in. I would also say—
Well, the circumstances really would lend only to two possibilities, the one that you offer and the one that you say is improper, which is the punishment, the idea of punishment, that the statute prohibits malicious punishment, and you're saying that the statute doesn't apply here because she wasn't really punishing the child, and if the only option for the jury as a matter of common sense under the circumstances is what you have offered and the possibility that this was for punishment, why wouldn't rejecting your client's position necessarily imply that the jury accepted the punishment motive?
I think one reason, Your Honor, is because there's no evidence of another motive. In fact, the prosecutor at the trial conceded, again at page 184, that Ms. Altemeter did not act to discipline JVR, that that's not what these actions were. And so if there's a fact dispute, if another witness had come in and given a different account of events or there had been a different account of Ms. Altemeter's statements, that would be a completely different story. I would also say, Your Honor, that even if some of that is true, it still doesn't deal with the reasonableness question and it doesn't deal with the maliciousness question. That even if Ms. Altemeter was frustrated or mad at JVR, again, look at what she did. Compare it to the conduct in other malicious punishment cases, which is what this court has done in other similar situations, both in malicious punishment cases and other sort of qualitative reviews of the sufficiency of the evidence cases, you'll see that you won't find, you won't find a case with this small amount of harm, bruises on the elbows, from this brief action, an otherwise innocuous action. There's clearly nothing inherently dangerous about grabbing a child by the arms at the elbows. The caregiver wasn't holding the child by the neck or by the groin, wasn't pinning the child down, certainly didn't strike the child in any way. You won't find another case like that. And you won't find another case where, regardless of how you want to slice the hair about was she punishing or was she not punishing, it's undisputed that what she wants the child to do is not return to the dangerous situation that the child was consistently returning to. And that's what her actions are designed to do. That's completely undisputed in this case. And you won't find another malicious punishment case animated by such a thing. We ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and your briefing that you submitted. We will take the matter under advisement, and so you each have a good day.